we are all different, and that's I look at what has happened to me, and I look at some of my friends, and I think, well, had that happened to them, we would have struggled to get them off the sofa. They probably wouldn't be doing a quarter of the stuff I'm doing. And I'm not saying that in any way, oh, this is fantastic, look at me, what I'm... I have found something that is driving me on, and I will grasp it and I will go with it. But I know that possibly other people in similar circumstances wouldn't have. And that's fine, but that's how they need to cope with it. And that's why we're all different, and there is no one size fits all for managing your grief or for managing anything that you have in your life. We all confront everything differently.
Hello and welcome. My name is Liz Gleason, and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from international guests who share their unique experience of grief. These stories are shared with the wish that you, the listener, may find some comfort, hope, and solidarity, and maybe also the realization that you're not alone in your grief. Each time you listen, please do support the podcast by donating on the website shapesofgrief.com or by becoming a patron on patreon.com. It's a privilege to hold these conversations, and I extend my deepest gratitude to all my guests for showing up in this particular way. It truly is a gift. So welcome back to the Shapes of Grief podcast. And I'm very happy today to be joined by Andrew McGinley. Andrew, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Liz.
We're here to talk about Andrew's three children, Carla, Dara, and Connor, and how Andrew is doing since the three of them died at the beginning of last year. Andrew has kindly agreed to speak today, knowing that many of you listening are also bereaved. And like anyone who talks on the podcast, Andrew's here in the hope that something he shares will touch somebody else who needs to hear it. So Andrew, I actually know very little about you. Are you a Dubliner?
Originally from Donegal, but I'm longer out of Donegal than I was in it. But I still claim my Donegal roots. I'm heading up there next weekend and stuff like that. I've been living in Dublin, back in Ireland since, what would it be, 96, and living in Dublin since then. So.
Okay. I can hear the accent now that you're speaking a little bit more. I can hear the twinge coming in. And I'm noticing under your hoodie there a little splash of colour and the word Connor.
Yeah, so that was the T-shirts that I had done up for the three projects. The three projects being based on promises that I'd made to the children. Shortly after they died, I just found myself standing outside the house. The house had become a crime scene, so you're told to leave. So I was standing outside, sort of somewhat bewildered. There was people talking to me, but I couldn't tell you who or what they were saying, or even if I was responding to them. I honestly don't know. What just going through my head was sort of the last time that I spoke to the kids, and sort of last time I held them and kissed them. And what went through my head mainly then was, the first thing that struck me was Connor, just before Christmas, had asked me to help him set up a YouTube channel. So, like anything, yeah, I said, yeah, I will. There's lots of promises that you make your kids, you know. I promise I'll bring you to the zoo. You bring them to the zoo. I promise I'll get you ice cream. You get them ice cream. But these were sort of promises that I hadn't sort of got round to keep. And so Connor, myself and Connor, we sat down. We thought, well, what are we going to do? We decided then comedy sketches. So I still have the notepad at home where we started writing down some comedy sketches, some ideas around comedy sketches. So we figured we needed to build up a bank of ideas before we would start filming, so that we could upload and film and come up with the ideas, and that we'd have one or two a week that we could put up. So that's after he died. We never got round to starting to film. But what I had was, I suppose, videos of the kids. So that's what I put up and created Connor's Clips. And I support that on Twitter and Instagram. It's Connor had a massive interest in the whole internet and with the iPad that he could, you know, Siri, you know, and ask a question and that she would give the answer. So he was fascinated with all that. So I think it's a great way to remember Connor and being able to keep his the promise of the YouTube channel and then support that on Twitter and Instagram as well. Carla wanted a snowman, so the logo was for the snowman is there as well. So on the 13th of November, the Irish Independent are going to be issuing the snowman for Carla competition. So I'm hoping to run that throughout the year with different scenes with the snowman. Maybe in the summer with his Hawaiian shirt and his Bermuda shorts out in the garden or something. So, but the first one is on 13th of November, a Saturday, and I find even when I was driving over here, it's not happiness and it's not joy, but there's a great sense of, to be able to buy the Irish Independent on the 13th of November, see Carla's colouring competition, will give me it'll just fill me with, and I still don't know the word, it's not happiness, it's not joy, but it will be, I've kept that promise and it means an awful lot. And
I people, see love, actually.
Yeah, I suppose it is love more than anything else. And then Dara was involved in everything. GA, hurling, soccer, athletics, drama club, Lego clubs. He was in everything. So I thought a fitting way to remember Dara would be a charity that would encourage people to get involved, as Dara did. And that's the name of the charity, As Dara Did. So that's what's is driving me on at the moment, is those sort of three projects. And then for myself, the two lads were prolific comic book writers. There's a box that I have in the house. It's just full of their homemade comics and books. So I'm going to take some of their characters and write books. And the books will contain Dara, Carla and Connor will be in there as characters in that as well. So Those drive me on. They're the projects that get me out of bed in the morning.
So these three projects have become a huge part of your life.
Yeah.
For anyone listening, I'm seeing the love flood over you, Andrew, as you speak about the three kids. How old were they?
9, 7, and 3. Connor was 9, Dara 7, Carla 3. It's funny, people have asked me the odd time, what age would they be now? And it stops me in my tracks, and I can't even do the sums. I said, no, 9, 7, and 3.
They're always going to be 9, 7, and 3 in your mind. Yeah. So, Andrew, for people listening, what would you like people to know about Connor, Dara, and Carla, and what happened? Have you found words to tell your story yet? I don't want to say it because it's not my story to tell. One of the things that we need to do following the death of someone we love is find the words that suit us to tell our story.
Well, like that, you still struggle with some of the words. It's like I was thinking of the project and I was happiness, joy, and then you said, is it love? And I go, yeah, actually, that's the word. So you still are scrambling around looking for the right word or what to call different bits and pieces. There was a piece on social media by Fiona Donoghue, who's the mother of Noah Donoghue, who died tragically in Belfast last year.
Yeah.
And she wrote that every morning when you wake up, it hits you that you're not going to get that hug that day. And I can relate to that because I try and get into a routine. I set my alarm off at 7 o'clock every morning. And it's like a sledgehammer hits you between the eyes at 7 o'clock. And then you have to get up. But it's those sort of, it's the projects that I'm doing that gets me up. But it's just a sledgehammer blow every single morning. that you have to recover from. But it's that love for the kids that that gets you going and gets you out and puts one foot in front of the other. I don't want to be a sad, mournful person, because that's not how the kids knew me. I know they would want me to be happy, so that's what I try, and doing their projects makes me, fills me with love that brings me, I suppose, a certain kind of happiness. And that's what I'll spend the rest of my days doing. But yeah, it's a tough start every single day. But you need to, I suppose, battle on.
You described that moment, Andrew, of standing outside your house, your home, which was now a crime scene. Do you recognize yourself since January 2020?
No, the first year, it's funny because the April was Dara's birthday. That was tough. Connor's birthday was in May, my own birthday. Father's Day ended up being the worst day. I spent it with friends, but I just wasn't there. I wasn't, you know, just wasn't in the room. And I wondered how I would get through. And then I had an experience with distance healing, which I didn't know what distance healing was, and somebody offered it to me with the second lockdown. So I did it, and I had an experience through that. That when I talked to other people about it, they said, oh, would you think of going to a medium? And I thought long and hard about it. Had you asked me 2 years ago, would I ever go to a medium? I would have said no. But I went. And she told me about a dozen things that only the kids would know. Some examples of that would be, she said, who would you like to speak to? And I thought, off the three of them, Connor's probably, you know, being the oldest, you know, so I said Connor. And she looked at me, she thought for a few minutes, and then she says, Connor would like you to take his white football boots out of the wardrobe and put them out beside Dara's shoes. And I had a pair of I hadn't told her Dara's name, and I had Dara's shoes sitting out on top of a chest of drawers, and I had Connor's white football boots and his shin pads and his football gear in the wardrobe. Nobody's looked into that wardrobe, only me. And if you asked anybody what colour would a kid's football boots be, they would probably guess any colour other than white. She told me a secret that Dara told me about 2 weeks before he died. I didn't tell anybody else because I thought, I won't worry anybody else about this. And it was a small thing, and I said, I'll sort it out myself. And she was able to tell me that word for word. Told me about a dozen other things that, you know, as I say, only the kids would know. So it got me thinking about how is that possible? Because I would think of myself as being a sort of a logical and a practical person. So I would now firmly believe that your energy or your consciousness or whatever you want to call it survives. I'm not religious and I'm still not spiritual, but I just believe that your energy survives, because when you sort of think about it, what makes you want to, you know, read a book or watch the television? What makes you think, will I cook something myself or will I order a takeaway? That's not your skin and bones. That's not your nervous system. That's not a physical part of you. That's your consciousness or whatever you want to call it. So when you die, does that survive because it's not the skin and bones and the...
some people would call it soul.
So what you call it skull. I kind of think soul is more religious, and I'm not a religious person.
But profound loss can rock our inner world. It's confusing, life-altering, and often scary. You've probably already figured out that there are no stages of grief. But are there other models, theories, tools, or practices that can help us to navigate the grieving process? To learn more, visit shapesofgrief.com. As Liz says, the more people who are grief-trained, the more supportive and compassionate our society will be. And that will make life so much better for anyone coping with loss and grief. Now, let's get you back to the podcast.
But again, when I spoke to the medium and she mentioned the word God, I says, oh, I'm going to stop you right there, because she said that was her term for it. But the more the energies sort of grow and learn and spend time, they know more and they become more learned. And they, I suppose that was just her term for sort of higher spirits. But she was, some of the stuff she said that, like, Connor had grown specifically, and there was a couple of things she said that I would know would have come from Connor, but sounded a bit more grown up than what than a 9-year-old. And I thought to myself, wow, you know. But I do take things with a pinch of salt, but as I say, there was things that she told me that only me and the kids would know.
What did that mean to you, Andrew?
It gave me great comfort. Yeah. Yes, gave me great comfort. Mm. And I think it's a comfort for me that when I die, and I hope I have 30, 40, 50 more years of doing these projects, that when I die, that my energy will survive and be with the children again.
So there's part of you that's waiting for...
It's
to
funny.
Be reunited with them,
yeah,
at some level.
It's you know, but it's not. It's funny. Somebody asked me. I was having a chat to a friend, and we were talking about how this has changed me. And one of the things that, and it came out of the blue, and it kind of just hit me all of a sudden. I said, I don't have a fear of death anymore. I think if I was on a jet plane that was plummeting towards the earth, I'd probably be the only person not screaming. But I've no intention of going anywhere anytime soon. I have these projects to do, and as I say, 30, 40, 50 more years of doing them. But I don't have fear of death, and I don't have you don't sweat the small stuff. You just get a sense of, listen, why would you worry about something like that? But everywhere you go, you just see people rushing and hurrying around and being worried about the small things. And you just, your whole perspective on life changes.
Andrew, you probably don't know this, but my last guest on the podcast was Christine Carlson. Her husband Richard died in a plane crash. Not a plane crash, he died on a plane. But he wrote the book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff.
Yeah.
You've just quoted him
there.
You said you had a chat with your friend about how this has changed you. How has this changed you, Andrew?
Well, certainly, I haven't gone back to work since. I used to deal with clients, and I suppose you deal with some of their worries and concerns, and certainly I look at some of their worries and concerns that they would have raised with me in the past, and I would think, no, don't be worried about that. No.
Your job?
I was I was an account manager with Sodexo, so we looked after workplace services, so catering, cleaning, maintenance, stuff like that. So, sometimes you would be in at meetings and there would be an issue raised, and everybody would feel, including myself, would feel it was an important issue. Now I think I look back and I go, nah. You know, why were we even worried about it, you know? So my perspective has sort of changed like that. It's funny, when before you started recording there, we were having a quick chat about speaking and talking. I would have been probably a very, I would say, private person. I had absolutely no social media or anything like that before this. But now I just feel that it is important to talk. I would never offer anybody any advice on grief. The only thing, like, people offered their advice to me, and I kind of think, so in a lot of cases, some of the stuff made sense, but a lot of the cases you just, maybe that worked for you, but it won't work for me. I think you do need to find your own way to a certain extent. But the only thing I would say to people is, whoever has died doesn't want you to be sad. And that's what I live by. I don't think whoever has passed, they don't want you to be, you know, they want you to be thinking about them, but they don't want you to be mourning about them or to be sad. Do you know? And that drives me on.
And it's such a good example, Andrew, of why grief is so unique. Because someone else hearing that may not want to hear that.
Yeah, I know.
And for you, it was the one thing
that
actually drives you on and that's been useful to you.
I mean, all aspects of the with what happened, because I've been speaking a lot about mental health, I've spoken to the minister, and I feel that, I suppose, what happened with us as a family was, I can only describe it as worst case scenario. But I feel if I don't talk about it, then no lessons will be learned. And if no lessons are learned, then potentially it could happen again. So I feel I have to talk about it. I know that there's people in the family that don't want to talk about mental health or grief, but I do now feel that it is important to talk about.
Would you be willing to say a little bit about what happened for listeners who may not be familiar?
I think probably most of the people would be aware that that their three children, their lives were taken by their mother in an act of insanity. She was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Looking at it, I believe it was an insane act. I can't think of it any other way. And for me, what is difficult is trying to explain that to people, because I think most people would think, oh, sure, there must have been signs, there must have been. There really, we knew that Dee was depressed and she was getting professional treatment for that. But she was part of the family. She was, you know, she was a loving mother. She was in the morning getting the breakfast for the kids, the school uniforms, the lunches, doing school drops. She was a part of a loving family. And, you know, even evidence that came out at the trial, it was, she was engaging with people at the school, having taken the lives of Dara and Carla. People will find that hard to understand. They would say, if it's insanity, how is that not visible? But nobody seen it on that day, engaging with her, chatting to her. And that's why I feel that mental health needs to be talked about, and what happened with us talked about, so that people realise that you it's not like a broken leg where there's a big plaster of Paris on it, or a cut head where there's a big bandage. It is an unseen illness to a certain extent.
Absolutely.
There was a post on social media by a guy called Speedo Mick. If you don't know Speedo Mick, he is an Everton football supporter, and I support Everton, so I know of him. But he walked Land's End to John O'Groats. He swam the Channel. His latest walk was Scotland, Ireland, Wales, and England, raising funds for mental health charities and homelessness charities. And he posted a picture, and the picture was of it was a photo montage of like the likes of Robin Williams and Kurt Cobain and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and they were all smiling in the pictures. And all the pictures were literally taken hours or days before they all took their own lives. And then the caption at the bottom is, "This is what depression looks like." And then you look at, and there was 9 pictures in it, and they were all happy, smiling people. So that just doesn't add up. So many people have written to me, and I've had a few conversations with different people. One woman told me that she was laughing and joking and dancing in her kitchen with her son about an hour before he took his own life.
Yeah.
That, unless you hear that, you would think, that doesn't make sense. That just doesn't. How can that be?
We make assumptions all the time.
I just think we don't know because people aren't really talking about it. I mean, one of the signs I'm told, what I know now, is that a person's mood lifts when they decide to take their own life.
Because they're looking forward to the relief.
Well, they make peace with the decision. And it's it's a weight off their shoulders.
Mm.
I didn't know that. So I look at our situation and what we probably thought was an improvement in Dee's mental well-being was probably that she had made up her mind to take her life. I thought we were at the end of the tunnel and that the treatment was working and that she was on the road to recovery. Whereas now I would strongly suspect that what we were saying was that she'd made peace with her decision to take her own life.
We only see the tip of the iceberg.
Well, unless people talk about it. And that's why I know, as I say, there's people in the family who may not want to talk about it, but I think it's as important that we do. So that other people can learn from that. There was a number of people who wrote to me saying that they had been attending psychiatric services with their 17-year-old child, and their child was, talking about taking their own life. And at the weekend, that child turns 18, and the parents are no longer allowed in at the next meeting unless with the patient's consent. Sorry.
Yeah.
So their last and sort of like the last bit of information they have is of their child speaking about taking their own life. So I think there's a lot around mental health that needs to be, particularly in the Mental Health Act, that needs to address that and being a more inclusive approach for patients, and probably making the act more patient-centric as opposed to just a process.
And to involve everybody around them as well.
Once there's a loving and supportive circle around. Mm. And even if it's not immediate family, people will have friends or relatives. You can find people. Everybody is somebody who loves them.
Yeah.
So, and in particularly in our case, we had a massive supportive circle of people who loved Dee. And we weren't included in our treatment plan.
And she was trying to get help. She was engaging with services.
Yeah.
She knew she wasn't okay. Mm. And she was trying to get help with that.
So that troubles me more than anything else. And I feel it needs to be talked about. I know, as I say, probably there's many members of the College of Psychiatry who would rather that I wasn't banging this drum, but I feel I need to. If the law goes through, there's an amendment before that's going to be presented shortly, I think, to the Oireachtas to be voted through. For me, it's just not worth the papers written on at the moment. It's just more process driven with some additional backside covering added in. In all honesty, that's what I see. I don't see it as being patient-centric and taking into account that we are all different. We all react differently. We're just different beings. It doesn't take that into account at all.
What's that like for you to see that?
It's frustrating, but all I can do, it's not me. I'm not in the Dáil or the Seanad voting for it. All I can do is try and make my voice heard. It's the same message that Una Butler had been chatting about. Una lost her two children in 2010. She was looking for the same changes to the mental health as I'm looking for now. Had Una been listened to, then there's a good possibility that Conor, Darren, Carla would be alive today. And that's quite difficult to take. I think had she been listened to, then there would be more of a focus on family inclusion and a supportive structure around the patient. And that can only be for the benefit of the patient and the family. And I think probably assist recovery of a patient.
I hear your anger and frustration when you talk about the system, Andrew. And when you spoke about Dee, I saw compassion in your face.
As I say, Dee was a loving mother, but she wasn't well.
Mm.
Again, I look at the way that patients are treated. I think mental health and mental health illness, when you look at it in comparison to other illnesses, it's an illness of the mind. So you would have to think that it's going to impact on everything that goes on in your mind, which is your thought process, your decision making, your responses. Yet the clinicians, if they're just dealing with the patient and the patient alone, are basing their treatment on those answers, responses, that thought process, those decisions from somebody whose mind is quite probably impacted by their illness. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm.
And I think things should make sense.
Absolutely. And I think if you speak to any psychotherapist, they'd agree with you.
But they're not anybody. They're not campaigning.
They're not. Yeah.
There was an expert group which is made up from the psychiatric services, professional services. If they're all in favour of it, then put it into law. At the moment, they call it proactive encouragement. They looked at, it's a recommendation that proactive encouragement for the patient to include their family or to have an advocate should be practiced. Then if they're all in favour of it, and there was an article by William Flannery, who is the head of the College of Psychiatry, saying that the vast majority of the college are in favour of proactive encouragement and having family inclusion, take it out, the recommendations, put it into law. Proactive encouragement at every single counselling session and every meeting with the patient. Explain them to them the benefit of having family. Where there is a loving and supportive circle, get them involved.
Yeah.
It's only to the good of the patient.
Absolutely. Is this going to be something that will be important to you moving forward to campaign for changes in legislation?
I have to talk about it, because if I don't, I would hate. Another gentleman rang me, or he wrote to me, and his children died in similar circumstances back in around the year 2000, about 20 years ago. And he wrote to me saying that he wished he had spoken out like I've done about the mental health act. And he didn't include his number or anything like that. And I had to try and track down his number to try and give him a ring to say, you can't be thinking that way. Because, like grief, you do what you feel is good for you or what you can do. And you may not be able to speak out.
Hmm. Grief can be paralysing for some people.
It can be.
Yeah.
And I understand that. We are all different, and that's... I look at what has happened to me, and I look at some of my friends, and I think, had that happened to them, we would have struggled to get them off the sofa. They probably wouldn't be doing a quarter of the stuff I'm doing. And I'm not saying that in any way, oh, this is fantastic, look at me, what I'm... I have found something that is driving me on, and I will grasp it and I will go with it. But I know that possibly other people in similar circumstances wouldn't have. And that's fine, but that's how they need to cope with it. And that's why we're all different, and there is no one size fits all for managing your grief or for managing anything that you have in your life. We all confront everything differently.
100%.
Yeah.
What I see in front of me is the father of three children who has purpose in life and who is fathering his three children. Although they are not here physically, you're very much, you speak about them, you engage in their stories, you are fathering your children, and that helps you to find purpose in life.
Yeah, I tend to talk about being a father as in the past tense. I still think of myself as a father to Connor, Darren, Carla, but I'm not a father because my kids aren't here. I was getting my hair cut recently, and the barber was chatting about her children, and I was just sitting in the chair dreading if she was going to ask me, do I have children? And I hadn't been in that situation sort of before, and I was sitting, how am I going to answer this? Because if I say yes, then it's going to be, oh, are they at school? And if I say no, is it going to shock her to find out who I am, and that, am I going to, like, if her hand started shaking, I'm probably going to end up with the worst haircut in the world. So I was just dreading it, and I still don't know how to answer that if a stranger asks me. And maybe I can tell them outright. As long as they're not holding a sharp implement, I'd be fine telling them who I am, and that, no, my children are, no longer here.
And it's this language is so important, isn't it, Andrew?
Yeah.
Do we speak in the past? Do we speak in the present? Am I still a father if my children are dead? How do I father them? All these questions are part of finding our meaning, finding our narrative. I hear this from bereaved parents all the time. How do I answer the question, how many children do I have? This is all part of it. And so what I'm hearing from you is this is still very much a work in progress. You're still stumped by that question.
Yeah, because I think when people say, oh, do you have kids? They're automatically, do you have kids who are alive? So, I still, as I sit here, maybe I'll think about it on the way home. I will answer it, but...
Maybe we need to change the narrative around that as well. I don't know if you noticed on social media over the last, this week actually, the wave of light for perinatal loss, anyone who's, lost a baby around the time of birth. And the campaign seemed to have been bigger this year than any other year. And every second person, particularly women that I know, seem to have a candle on their timeline for the baby that they lost, either through miscarriage or stillbirth. We're starting to talk more and more about grief. But I think traumatic loss is still taboo. Or like you say, will someone drop a sharp implement if I tell them what happened? But many people are bereaved from traumatic loss, and they have a right to talk about their grief and a right to talk about what happened and a right to support from friends and family and community.
I think that it's only, and it's hard to say this, but I feel it's only the parent, because I would have had the kids in my life 24/7. So there's school teachers, there's football coaches, there's friends. There's a lot of people grieving. But the hole that's in the parent's life, you look at if a baby is stillborn, the mother has been with that child for 9 months. And nobody will know the grief other than the parents. And that's full stop. End of story. Everybody else will feel sorry and will grieve to a certain extent as well, but nothing to the extent of the parents. And for me, it's the parents who should be listened to. So if, like, I've been to one meeting with Anam Cara, who support parents of children who have died, and it was probably too early for me to go, but there was a lady there, and she spoke about she hadn't touched the room of her child who had died, and I couldn't understand that. Like, I looked at the kids' rooms and I felt I looked at all their toys and I felt the joy that the kids had got from the toys. That joy needed to continue. So some of their toys went to nurseries and to schools and to friends and stuff like that. For me, I couldn't leave their rooms just untouched and as a shrine to them. But I understand how people do want to do that. And that has to be respected. That's the parent. That's nobody else's opinion matters.
Like you say, there's no one way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, what's right for you isn't for someone else. And someone else, you know, has a totally different way of doing things. And that's right for them. Yeah. You're so right when you say everyone has to figure it out for themselves. You said, you know, and I 200% agree with you, nobody can understand what you have lost, or as a bereaved parent, no one can understand what that person has lost, except maybe another bereaved parent who might have an idea. What is it that people need to know, Andrew?
Oh, you can't. You just, everybody's grief is unique to them. But I'd say for a parent in particular, because you know, when I look at Connor, there was 9 years of his life that he was in my life 24/7. From changing nappies to first words to, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and trying to get him back to sleep to learning to walk to, you know, tying his shoelaces to, you know, nobody else is doing that. You know, people are dropping in and out of their lives, but it's 24/7 that there's just a massive gap in your life. And so nobody, like, I won't know what it feels like for, I mentioned her, Fiona Donoghue, with Noah. I can understand, I can relate to her, she's lost a child, but I don't know her feelings. I would have a damn good guess of what she feels like.
Yeah.
Or as we spoke about, a mother whose child is stillborn. You know, for 9 months to care and cradle that child in your womb, and, you know, it's you just, I suppose what I've been through, I can understand the loss, but I don't know what's in that person's mind or how they're coping, or so, you know, it is.
We need to listen.
Listen, yeah, and it's.
And learn and understand.
Yeah.
What have you learned about grief, Andrew?
Ah, listen, there's days I sit down and I can start an email. I might have, right, today I'm going to be, you know, I need to get this done. Right, I need to sit down and do an email to Liz, and I'll sit down, hi Liz. The next thing, an hour and a half has gone by, and I'm still, and I kind of, Jesus, all I've written is, hi Liz. There's days where you don't operate. You know? I think, for me, given the way that the Connor, Darren, Carla died, there's a lot of complications around that. And that's an added burden. The trial was not easy. The coroner's court is coming up, stuff like that. You know, with a death in the way that the kids have, they had, you know, going in to identify their bodies in the morgue, I'll never forget it. It was probably the most traumatic experience I'll ever have. And, You know, lowering their bodies into the grave, you shouldn't have to do that. You know, Christmas morning, standing at their grave, that's something that nobody else is doing that. That was me, and I'm standing there. I'm there, I'm identifying their bodies. That trauma, that you could get consumed by that, and I try not to. But nobody else understands that.
Mm.
They can have a fair idea if they've had their own loss, but you know, all the complications that are coming with the way the children died, it just adds to it. But I feel I have to move on, and I'm just focused on the sort of the four projects that I'm doing. So, you know.
Does it help you to tell your story?
I think it's important to talk so that other people mm. understand. And think mainly about mental health. For me, if I don't talk about it, then other people won't understand. But if they hear me and they see the signs in their loved one, maybe we can stop a similar tragedy. If I can shout loud enough and that enough politicians take on board what I'm saying and the law changes to the benefit of patients to avoid such a tragedy happening again, then I suppose it'll have the benefit of talking will have come to some good.
It'll have been worth it, to talk.
So,
yeah. I'm struck, Andrew, when you describe their standing on Christmas Day by the children's graves and the pain of looking at their bodies in the morgue. Who has helped you? Like the loneliness of that, I'm just imagining.
Our family, like my sister, my friends, they've been great. But, you know, my sister's been through her own loss, and, you know, my friend who came to the morgue with me is, you know, his mother had passed. But I think the loss of a child, I said it for years, you should never have to bury a child. And I buried three of them, and it is different, I think, to a loss of a parent or of a loss of a friend, or, you know.
It's out of the order of things,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
It's not what we assume.
Yeah.
And I think when someone young dies, never mind three young people, our assumptions about our future are shattered in that moment.
Yeah.
So what helps you get up? You've talked about you said four projects.
Oh yeah, Connor's Clips is the YouTube and the Twitter and Instagram. Snowman for Carla is the colouring competition that's going to be in the Independent. The charity As Dara Did. And then the fourth one is the books that I'm going to write that will have all the kids in them. And I hope that that's what's going to keep a roof over my head and keep the lights on. Because I don't think I'll ever be able to go back to doing what I was doing. I've just my whole perspective on life has changed in relation to what I used to do. So, As I spoke a few minutes ago, a lot of my work was emails and communications, and if I'm going to spend an hour and a half just writing "Hi Andrew," I'm not going to be very productive at work. But I think finding something that has that meaning to me, I'm aiming for about 30,000 words on the book, and I'm up to about 10,000, so I'm getting there, and I have an illustrator lined up, and I have ideas for around 12 books. So yeah, I just need to get the time to get sitting down and get writing. And
Have you got some good hands on your back as you do these projects?
I mean, for the charity, there's a good team of trustees who are driving it on. I have great support from the Irish Independent now, who are taking the lead on the colouring competition. Connor's Clips is mostly myself. I do all the tweets and the Instagram and take the photographs. So that's the one that I'm probably most hands-on with. And then the books is just me, and I'll work with an illustrator then on the illustrations. So.
I see the children brought to life every time you're talking about these projects in your face and the love, you know, your whole demeanor changes. Tell us a little bit about them. Who was Carla? I mean, I know anyone in Ireland would know these three children because you share their pictures a lot, and they're just divine little beings. Who was Carla?
The funny thing was, with the three of them, they were such good friends, and what sums it up for me is there was a clip where Carla had her little fairy costume on, her little wand, and she goes into the two lads who were in the front room, and I don't know what they were doing, either doing some Lego or they were watching television or whatever, and she just waddles into them and she goes, "You're now frogs." Now, a lot of older kids would have went, you know, "We're watching television.
Get out, we're watching TV." Close the door.
The two boys got down and started jumping around like frogs. And I was coming in behind Carla and I was carrying my phone. I didn't say, "Oh, lads, now play along. You need to..." It was just, they automatically, because they thought it would be a fun thing to do and that Carla would get a laugh out of it. And she did. And so that sums up the three of them. They were such good friends. But then their projects show how individual they were. Because Carla loved snowmen, she loved colour, and she would sit down and you would give her a ream of paper and, you know, she would just scribble away. She loved colouring, and I'd come in from work sometimes and she'd sit down, I actually tweeted there was a photograph. She used to have her little creche with all her dolls. So she had five or six dolls there and she was feeding them, and she used to call it her creche. Or she had a little kitchen as well where she would cook up stuff. So she'd go, "Daddy, dinner's ready." And it was for me to sit down on the sofa so she could cook something out of her little kitchen for me. Connor had got to that stage. He'd grown up and, you know, very much about... We'd given them an old camcorder that we had. And again, on Connor's clips, you'll be able to see the movie with Lego, as we call it, to avoid copyright infringement. And there was like, I think it's a 10-part Lego movie where they did the whole scenes and all of this. You'll also see in Connor's clips where they got two guitars, and they were cheap guitars that they'd got in a shop, and they had just decided they were going to form their own band. So I've no doubt that the two lads were going to be very creative. But I think in probably different ways, whereas Connor was more sort of like, the whole background and the structure of how things were. I think Dara was a bit of the showman and the very much involved in everything, and would have been like, you know, I remember we moved into the house that where I'm in now. We moved in 2018. Dara was straight out to all the kids introducing himself and who he was. And
great. Yeah.
I don't know, he would have been five at the time, you know, but this is who I am. Who are you? So their little personalities shone through, and they almost shine, you know, you can almost see that in their different projects and in what they're...
I feel it and see it and hear it from you now.
Yeah.
Very
and
much.
A lot of people, it's funny you said that about, a lot of people tell me I visibly lift when I talk about the kids and their projects as opposed to anything else. So, but yeah, I suppose
so tell us about, as Dara did, you have a big raffle coming up, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So I suppose Connor's clips, I kind of launched pretty much, I think it was April 2020, shortly after, because that was the project that was sort of, I knew we'd started work on with Connor, with Connor's clips. The others kind of took a bit of time to work through what I thought. So as Dara did, is we had to go through the charity process, which there's a lot of regulation around charity. So that kind of delayed us a bit. But we're now an official charity. So there's two sort of ways of fundraising that we have, that we're looking for people to support us. One is by monthly donations. So people can sign up to a monthly donation. And if they do that, they get entered into a draw. So... Niall Quinn, the ex-Irish footballer, is providing me with some prizes. We just gave away a signed Manchester City jersey, a big football team in England. And this coming, the next quarter, which will be the draw on the 31st of December, Jordan Henderson, the Liverpool captain, is providing prizes. So Niles organised that as well for me. So it's a nice prize for anybody who signs up for as little or as much as they want on a monthly basis.
I can and imagine Dara jumping up and down.
So it's as Dara, D-A-R-R-A-G-H, did dot A-E, as Dara did dot A-E. So you'll find Support Us, which is the monthly donation. So if you want to get in for the Liverpool stuff, you need to be donating before December. And then I'm absolutely delighted that I suppose our Irish musical superstar Daniel O'Donnell is stepping forward to do a concert for me. So we're raffling tickets. So there'll be 30 winners, and each winner will get 4 tickets to the concert. Overnight accommodation in the Louis Fitzgerald Hotel. The concert, sorry, is going to be in the Newcastle Community Centre. And the reason that I'm doing that is I live in Newcastle, and the local community just rallied around and supported me. I wouldn't be standing if it wasn't for them. So it's in Newcastle. Louis Fitzgerald, who has the local hotel, is supplying rooms. Sodexo, who I work for, and Derry Clark, who people will know of from RTE, from Irish television, they're doing the food. And Derry lives locally as well. And then the local bus service, Jewelway Coaches, are bringing people from the hotel to the concert and from the concert back. So literally, if you're one of the winners, 4 tickets, you just need to show up at the hotel with 3 of your friends or family, and you'll have a great night out. And I'm so thankful to Daniel. So the raffle tickets are on asdaradid.ie, €10 each.
So buy a ticket, people, if you're listening. If you're abroad, buy a ticket, and if you win, you can send them to me. It's a fantastic cause, and it's lovely, Andrew, that you're able to access the love so easily that you have for your children, and that their death and how they died is just part of a life that these little children lived.
So a lot of the projects now that we're doing, so the funds are going to clubs and societies who are looking for people to get involved. So the project specifically has to be around participation, as Dara did, because Dara was involved. So if everybody does as Dara did, then our clubs and societies would be well, you know, manned, and we would have a lot of people getting involved. And somebody said it to me. So we were doing there was a new camogie team in Ballyboden Wanderers Club. They had 100 years of GAA history, but hadn't a camogie team. So as Dara did, sponsored their kit for their first camogie team ever. And somebody said to me, wouldn't Dara just be so proud to see all these jerseys with his name on it? And it's funny, because I went back to the medium again recently, and she said, oh, Dara's delighted with his project. He says his is the biggest and the best project, you know, and that'd be typical Dara, you know, but in one way, kind of, you know,
sibling, you know, rivalry.
But
well, you're the embodiment of what we call continuing bonds in grief theory. And this came from, you know, we used to think long ago that when someone we love died, we had to grieve them and then move on and get on with it. And it was actually Freud who said that. And then his daughter died. He thought, okay, this is baloney. I don't want to move on and get over them and forget them. So we now know that it's much more realistic that what people want is to continue a bond with their loved ones after they've died. To, you know, I think it's, I don't remember the guy's name. He wrote Tuesdays with Mari. He says, death ends a life, but not a relationship. Mitch Albrum, I think that's his name. So death ends a life, but not a relationship. We still relate to those we love who have died. And it sounds like you're doing a beautiful job of continuing bonds with your 3 children. They're coming alive in you, in your love and in your face as you talk about them, how they were, and how they're continuing to bring joy through these 3 projects.
I mean, that's the way I look at it, is you can't, I do want to move on with life. I want to live the best life I can lead. I don't want to waste a second of it, but I want to do it with them and their projects and carry that along with me. So yeah, there is a sense of moving on, but yeah.
Moving forward with them, right?
Yeah.
Well, I wish you peace in your heart, Andrew.
Thank you.
And that day will come, and that sledgehammer that hits you every morning will gradually get softer and softer.
Yeah, the problem is I don't think it will. But it's how I think every day as the projects gain momentum.
One day at a time.
Yeah, that it is kind of that there will be a day where, yeah, it'll still hit me, but the love, I suppose, I'm not going to use the word happiness or joy of the projects, the love that comes with those projects will hit me quicker than what it does at the moment, because there'll just be so much going on with them that it'll help me cope probably more with that sledgehammer blow.
And I think that's something that is imperceptible over time, and that maybe one day you'll say, oh, wasn't so painful today. More love than pain. I think that's what a lot of us hope for with grief, is that we begin to remember more with love than with pain eventually.
Yeah.
At some stage. Well, I'm so grateful to you coming to speak with me today, and I hope, I've no doubt that something you have said today will land in the heart of somebody listening and will help them. And I genuinely wish you well with your projects, particularly as Dara did, .ie. Dara spelled RRAGH.
The right way.
The right way. And I do hope that you will find peace as you move forward with your three children, and that Dee will also find peace at some stage also.
Thank you very much, Liz. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice. And if your grief is making you unwell, please do see your healthcare provider. Once again, please consider supporting the podcast by donating on shapesofgrief.com or becoming a patron on patreon.com. I rely on your support to keep going. The music is performed by Baka Beyond, especially for the Shapes of Grief podcast. Until the next time, from me, Liz Gleeson, take really good care. She has come down to condemn
and their eyes are bound round with ship's sail. She has come down to condemn the wide ocean for the murderous loss of her man. His boat sailed out last Wednesday morning, and it's feared she's gone down with all hands.
Absolutely gorgeous.